Right, welcome to all. We can start. It's a pleasure to have Fatmir Besimi with us today for this seminar. Fatmir is a senior visiting fellow here at LISI, at our research unit on Southeast Europe, and he's working, as you will see, on questions of EU integration and structural reforms in the Western Balkans. He has a PhD in economics from Staffordshire University, but I think he's better known for his political his involvement in his political career and also in banking and so forth. He was Deputy Prime Minister for European Affairs in Macedonia between 2013-2016, Minister of Defence 2011-2013, Minister of the Economy for different periods. He was also Vice Governor at the National Bank and an economist at the World Bank prior to this. He has also taught at the universities in Skopje and Pristina, and he is increasingly, I think, or that's what he's telling me, reshifting his focus to his academic self rather than his politician self, although this may be time variant, so I don't know for how long. In any case, today he's wearing his academic hat and he's going to talk to us about the role of EU integration in enhancing credible structural reforms in the Western Balkans. Fatmir, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Vasilis. Thank you all for coming here tonight in this presentation. I'm looking forward on presenting to you some work, research work that I have been doing while during this program as a visiting senior fellow at the LSE Research on Southeastern Europe. First of all, I'd like to thank the team here for the support, and we'll try to make a brief presentation on the topic which was mentioned, the role of EU integration in enhancing credible structural reforms in the Western Balkans. The idea why I choose this topic and what I wanted to bring here is initially coming from my experience, from my background, taking the responsibility in the office as in the portfolio in charge of European affairs in my country, and the challenges that we faced in this process, and of course in addition to this what was for me a special interest was what are the political implications or the political economy implications on the reforms. And the idea that I also was looking for is to find a more comprehensive academic interpretation of this. What is looking through the literature, what is the debate, and also what we can present for the cases for the Western Balkans, and try to draw some findings from there and design a platform or the model for this to explain what's going on. So the process I was trying to share with you on this research is to go through bringing some, just for refreshing, bringing some information about the context, then some evidence and the literature review, the model and policy implications and recommendations, and some conclusions on the on this from this research. So if we talk about the context, I just bring here something which is known, which is in all documents that you can see in within European Union institutions, about the enlargement process. And the context is that it's in an open process for the countries that has interest, and for the Western Balkans, so you have the Copenhagen criteria, the stability and association process, which assumes that countries, in addition to fulfilling these criteria and Copenhagen criteria, also increase the regional cooperation. Then the other steps, which is candidate and potential candidate and accession negotiations and the rest. So we see the countries from the Western Balkans being here in between the candidate, potential candidate, and in the process of negotiations starting. So looking more deeply on the context about the EU enlargement in the Western Balkans, we saw that European Union designed a model for the Western Balkan countries which is more specific in increasing certain conditionality in the process of EU integration, because and it was the stability and association process, which has some the aim of political stabilization of the region, enhancing regional cooperation, as I mentioned, and then offering eventual EU membership. And different tools has been designed there, as a trade concessions through this agreement, economic financial assistance, and other assistance in financing and supporting projects. And of course, then signing the Stability and Association Agreement. Recently, in recent years, we have seen that this process, as it evolves, that has been proposed the new approach, which is proposing, suggesting that chapters 23 and 24 are opening first, and most likely that will close last. And this is the case with Montenegro and Serbia. Focus is on implementation, and five steps are designed for strengthening the negotiations, which is the action plans, opening interim and closing benchmarks, and concluding negotiations. So more intensive monitoring of the process. This also is considered to be a living document, and corrective measures, which assumes that countries and European Commission will work on updating and looking more specifically on the cases, how the countries progress and redesign or reshape the documents. Then assistance and monitoring instrument. This is also considered that through this process it will be assisted countries to do better reforms and, of course, more intensive monitoring. What is specific in this approach is that also this disequilibrium clause, which considers that okay, you open chapters 23, 24, which has to deal with rule of law, human rights, and, of course, governance. And the idea is, if countries, what happens if countries open these chapters and at the meantime open other chapters, and they show delay within these two chapters? And there is always this opportunity that the European Commission can call this clause and stop other chapters while it is balanced progress in all chapters. So that was about the context of the EU integration process. So I bring here to share what happens with the EU integration process through this period. What is the evidence on the progress? So I took some data from the transition report from EBRD. And starting from the 90s, when it started the process of transition, and until 2012, what is going on. As you can see from the graphs, the transition indicators, first is transition indicators among the countries, then you see on different sectors. So in the 90s, we see there has been larger progress. Then it's steady. So we see that in the later period there is less progress on structural reform, but there are two explanations of this. One is that there is a slowdown in the process, but second is that the bigger changes has been achieved in the at the beginning, and then you have less reforms made during the period. But in order to have a better analysis, what happens, where these reforms are taking, we made bring some comparison with other countries that are new members in EU, but also with EU members. And you can see that if we take the World Governance Indicators and Global Competitive Index, you see that with the red color, you have Western Balkans, and they really have in terms of world governance indicators, they are doing worse than new member states, and they are still far from EU 17. But in terms of competitiveness, they are just doing a bit less than EU new member states, but they lag behind the European countries. So this is something that I worked out through from the reports, progress reports 2016 and 2017, and that was possible to compare If we're talking from the context of Copenhagen criteria, convergence criteria, I thought it might be good to have them on this format. So we have three sets of political economy criteria and acquis, and we have for the upper row is 2015 and 2016. So what is here is you have on the vertical axis you have the readiness, and on the horizontal axis you have the progress. So you get two indicators from the progress report. One is at what stage is the country ready, readiness, and the second is how fast it moves. And what I wanted to bring here, the map of the region, how countries, at what stage they are, what level they are within the convergence criteria, and how fast they move. It was impossible to make a time series because it's only in the last 2 years that they introduced a new methodology. Before these years, they are not consistent. So what is here, what these figures are telling us that countries show more progress in terms of if you are in acquis, because here is they are doing well in this angle, and here they are low performance, and here are high performance. So you see that in political political criteria, all countries are on below the medium in terms of the readiness, and in terms of progress, they show certain progress. But in terms of economic criteria, they are higher, and in acquis, they are higher. So what is this graph telling us, as I want to show from the experience? Here you see that they make the law, they make the legislation. There is no problem to draw the legislation, and they are here. When you talk about the economic criteria, which is consistent with competitiveness index that we just showed, they still are doing that. But when you are in political criteria, there still is a lot of work to do. So I will come back later to this, but in chapter, what is the new approach telling us is focusing on 23 and 24, which needs to have this, but also there is a focus on implementation, which will tell us that this is not just writing the legislation. The specific things that I will come later on, but when I will present these, the findings, is here. If you look on the case on the political criteria, Serbia and Montenegro. Compare this with the previous period, you see that Serbia and Montenegro, although they have been lower in previous years, I compared them, they are moving faster. And this is due to the opening, I mean the endogenous effect of the integration process, and we, if countries start negotiation, they can perform better than if they don't start. Next slide, I will try to, what I was trying to do is to show whether there is some correlation. It's not a sophisticated econometrics, just correlation, putting the data of the readiness and the, what we have, the it's the GDP per capita compared to EU average, so convergence. What I find in all three criteria is that countries from the region that are more advanced, or their share of GDP, their GDP per capita as a share of EU level, they perform. They are at higher level of EU of readiness with these criteria, convergence criteria. This graph does not show us the causality. Whether growth helps structural reforms or vice versa. But just we can see clearly that there is this positive correlation. Did some work on this, trying to bring here also what happens with convergence and catching up, since we'll see that the literature on this was bringing this discussion about the convergence as a challenge and catching up where the countries stay. The first graph is bring 2005-2015 about the GDP per capita as a share of EU average for countries of the Western Balkans, and then we have these Western Balkans, the same indicator, but comparing with new member states. What is here the characteristic that we see here on the economic crisis. Until before the economic crisis, convergence is faster, then it slows down. But what happens here with the new member states is the same. You know, you can see that it goes slower, but compared to the new member states are getting better or faster convergence with the EU average after the economic crisis. So it means that the EU enlargement was less effective than the policies within the EU about the convergence. So there is still room for the EU enlargement process to get to help the countries from the region to have a faster growth or convergence. So talking about structural reforms and convergence, as I mentioned, three aspects I bring here. There was a discussion, wide discussion, but inconclusive, about the causality between structural reforms, growth, and convergence. And here we are not discussing it. Just I bring for the discussion here this information. And there is a statistical evidence of convergence of the Western Balkans with the EU that I just showed, but and positive correlation that I presented. And we are looking here, which is have not seen a lot of discussion in the literature, about the political economy effect in terms of reforms and convergence. So what we found out is that there has been an evidence that there is initial progress, but in the recent years we see that it slowed down. And the literature discussion is that EU integration still remains important for the Western Balkans. And the challenges that remain are how the countries can catch up with the EU level, EU standard, and how the structural reforms can be enhanced within this process. So we consider that possible contribution to this discussion can be in introducing a political economy effect on the structural reforms, introducing to the discussion this, and also about the credibility discussion, about the credibility of structural reforms, the role of EU integration for sustainable reform process and growth. So accordingly, the research objective is to see about the role of EU integration enhancing credible structural reforms in the Western Balkans, and we followed this methodology. We wanted to introduce an economic model that considers the political economy effect of structural reforms in a dynamic world with rational expectations. And why we do that is because, as I mentioned at the beginning in my introduction, in this process when I talk about structural reforms, competitiveness, growth, policymakers also face the impact of the political fact, because they are going for an election, they want to get voted, and this how we wanted to bring this political economy relevance to this discussion. And for that, I implemented the Kidland and Prescott and Barrow and Gordon model on policymaking with rational expectation, take into consideration the credibility and the timing consistency in policy decision. But also I leverage from some insights from discussion with Vasilis, but also he had some presentation on this, the model on EU reform, leverage and cost of structural reform. So, and now I'm going to present to you the model. So what is the model about? We have here the government who faces the trade-off between reforms and support, public support. But due to the explanation of the model, I bring there the reform gap or reform delay, you'll see, and the support loss that they do. So they face this trade-off. And the objective of the government is to maximize the welfare, actually to bring this to zero. So zero reform gap, there is no reform gap, and they will have full public support. So this is the government preference. And then we see what is the constraint in the society. And the constraint in society is explained there. So what is happening? So here we are looking at the certain group, the specific reforms that have a negative impact on the rents, on certain group in the society, on economic agents. And what I mean here is are the reforms on public administration, reduction of public administration, some budget constraints, and also some changes on environmental law and legislation that requires additional investment from the company, reducing of profits, and other, and as well as fighting corruption and other stuff. So you see that certain groups, if you have higher reforms, you lose their support, and so this is what the government faces as a constraint. And we assume that the society or the economy is at this level of national support. And this depends on overall EU attitude, optimism or skepticism. We call it skepticism because we have it support loss. It can be lack of credibility in EU integration process and corruption within the government and some other stuff that have this negative impact for the support in the model. You can have these different types in the reality. The public, you can have a country with a reformer public, and you can have with pro-reform public. So these are the constraints. Then you can have a government who is reform-averse and pro-reform government. And here the natural support, different from the model that I mentioned, Kitland and Prescott, they assume this to be fixed. But after we had some discussion for our model, and also Barra and Gordon, they released the assumption that Kitland and Prescott made. We say that also here the EU can help, can move this to the left. So what this means, now I come to the model. This is the model that we present. So there are two choices what this model presents on the credibility. I want to focus your attention on the credibility, what this model says for the structural reforms, and what we later on suggest some policy recommendations for countries, but also for European Commission. So, as I mentioned, the European Union would have an interest with the country, and the country would have an interest to have reforms at this stage. Zero, no reform delay, no reform gap. And assume that the country is at this level with support of the government. And this is the equilibrium that they expect. So reforms with this level. But what we say that this is not time consistent, because the government facing this constraint and having this interest, this preference curve, will find it of interest to reduce, actually to increase the support that they have, because if you go like this, they increase the support, and by reducing or delaying some reforms. In public administration, if you are expecting elections to happen next year, and you have agreed for, reform, cutting the administration, then government has an incentive to postpone this for a year. So what will happen will come to this point. And this is, you know, in mathematically explained, this is what mentioned that the tangent of this concave indifference curve is equal to this line where is the constraint in the society. But that's some mathematical background of it. So what happens now? We assume, this model assumes that you have rational expectation agents. They will anticipate what government is doing. And they will know that government next year has to do that. So they shift back their support to this stage. And you have moved from this level to this level with the same support and reform delay or reform gap to this stage. And this will go again to this several steps until we come to this stage. And what this model tells us that they will end up with the same support but with reform gap, which is this one. And this is what we claim within this model in our research, is that this is what's happening. You see that countries in the recent years, facing this reform gap or reform delay compared to the previous years, because they lose the perspective. And the governments find it interesting also either with a populist attitude or some other interest that delay the reforms in the integration, but still the support is low. They still are facing the same. So what the model explains us here brings this explanation. And this explanation is what is the reform equilibrium. So the reform equilibrium is, it will depend, or reform gap will depend, as I explained, what are these, what is the public stance, what is the government preference, and how do you move this natural support. So these are what this equation is telling us. And depending on that, you will move the reform on this through this line. It can be higher or lower, depending if the government has higher credibility, you end up here. So what we say here is that, or you move this to the left. So what is the interest now? The interest is that we move this equilibrium towards this. And if we talk about the speed, you can consider this visualized in like you are in a car driving, and this is your speeding, telling your speed. Being here, this line, moving here, you are on a higher speed. Going to the left, you are on a lower speed of reform. So this is how the model shows us. So, and we would like to, from this, what we will come with the policy, we will explain some policy implication, and then we go to policy recommendation. Or policy recommendation will go to the state. Either you move down, or you move basically here, to this point. So in order to move there, you have three aspects. One is on the government preference, second is interventions on the public support, and third is on moving the external or natural support, which we consider to be the factors that will improve the governance, rule of law, and the rest. So let me just say to you what are the policy implications, what the model tells us. The reform gap is higher when we have the difference between the government support loss target and natural support loss larger. This terminology is here a bit complicated because I'm talking always on the negative, reform gap and support loss. So what does this, the first tells us that if you have higher K, actually if you have the reforms or this line, the vertical line, if you have to the right, you have a higher reform gap. But the second tells us that if the weight that the government gives to the reforms is lower, you have also a higher reform gap. And the responsiveness of the society, of the public to the reform is higher, then you have higher reform gap. And we will expect, in general, you will expect that if you have less reforms, that will have higher support. So this is the intuition. Because with the reform, someone will lose interest. Because we are talking, just to remind back, that we are talking not about all reform, but just the specific reform that has a negative impact on certain groups. And so the intuition is that lower reform increase support. But what happens here, if the model tells us that lower reforms will not have higher support, but the support will remain the same, and you have end up just with higher reform gap. And this is, as the model explained, this is because you have rational expectation and you have the credibility issue. If you have a government that people trust and you have a policy, reform policy with commitment, then economic agents and public will trust it, and when they move and when they agree here, so when they agree at this point, they know that the government will deliver this. If the government is less credible, they know that the government will have an incentive to reneach what has been cleared or cheat and come to this point, and they will play this game until they come here. So what is now the policy recommendation is that you end up, so we have two equilibriums here. These are just transitional stages. But the model tells that we have two equilibriums. Here is the optimal, because you are on a higher, you do the reforms with the same support, and here is time consistent, and this is not time consistent. Here is time consistent, but it's suboptimal because you have end up with a reform gap. And our idea, our intention is to try through this model to bring some policy recommendations that how you can improve the credibility of structural reforms. So what is in the literature, and Borrow and Gordon was mentioning, is borrowing the credibility. So the institutions that can you, the countries borrow the credibility for structural reforms is the European Commission. So the role that European Commission can play in this process. And the channels that they can do this are these three components that we mentioned, either the government preferences reforms, either the in the society, or you work here on these natural supportive sector, external factors on the credibility of the process overall. So I try to summarize and bring some a list of policy recommendations. So what is the first, let's say, conclusion? This needs a bit to be rewritten in order to be more simple, specified for what is clear policy recommendation, but these are the implications and recommendations. So what we see here is the first is that the model tells us clearly that there should be considered also the political implication of the reforms. So the government takes this component into consideration. So when European Commission negotiates with or impose some agenda to the government, it should take into consideration that the policymakers take into account on their decision the political implication of their decision or reform process. Then the second is that in order to have a more credible, once you consider that component, the political support, then you have to consider the models that you have consistent policy rule with commitment. So make sure that what is agreed, there is a strong rules or procedures that the government follows. So there should be some credibility institutionalized. What in the model Kidland and Prescott say, and also other literature on this, usually they say you introduce some law, some legislation. So have the power of law, so the government cannot change it. Here we may assume that if you, what is in the progress report for this year, and you do a national program for the next year, maybe some issues, or what is the action plan, or whatever the country have in national program should have the force of the power of the law, the power of the law, so you are sure that the government will do that, and then there is no reform delay or reform gap, and still the support will not change for the government, so they will feel more comfortable in that. So then you have, talking about the pace of reforms process that I mentioned, this with dotted lines. If EU wants to, or countries want to increase or to accelerate the reform process, there are three channels: government preferences, public stance, and the level of natural support, credibility of the reform process, governance, and corruption. So accelerating these reforms need some recommendations or interventions on these three channels. So accordingly, we have some suggestion that it can be that EU, through different programs, financial programs or investments or initiatives, compensates the loss, makes investments for leverage, and also have an inclusive open process for the ownership. So this increases, moves the equilibrium to the center of the graph, as you mentioned. So reduces the reform gap. And finally, we say that the transparency, all process will help the process increase the credibility. I just made a few comments here to see what is the new approach telling and how this model fits with that. So in the new approach, it's consistent with what we just said, and we just will add up on that what is actually existing. That it may also consider the political economy implication, which assumed here is the definition. Maybe we'll need further discussion on this. The flexibility into setting up conditionality with country specific, but being strict in implementation, because the credibility here affects. And then we have transparent and cross-country competitive and comparative process that you can see which countries. This will be additional pressure to the government. Then enhancing structural regional reform, cooperation. Final support, investments, and other promoting new initiatives can help the overall optimism or support for EU integration process, as it is Berlin process, regional connectivity, investment process. This will move the red line, vertical line, to the left. And overall, EU optimism and skepticism, or versus skepticism, in the EU member states and the Western Balkans can will affect the credibility of structural reform. So as a conclusion, I would like to share with you that the findings that we have from this research is that the credible reform process should consider the political economic effect and the timing consistency of the policy makers. Ignoring the political economic effect implies that we end up with suboptimal reform policy, which brings some reform gaps. A new integration can play a role in enhancing credible structural reform. Limitations are that the model is considering only the case where there is a trade-off between reforms and political support, while the default assumption is that reforms have positive correlation with political support. And finally, for further work, we may say that there should be some empirical investigation of the model, which might be helpful to evaluate the findings of the model, whether they, in the reality, the figures tell us the same story. And the model can be also extended for the structural reforms within the EU member states. So this is the thing.
Yeah, I found it all very interesting and very clear, but maybe some people in the audience may have also questions about aspects of the presentation. But we have questions on the specifics of the model, but if you're not model experts, or you don't take issue with that, we can also have a bit of a discussion, I imagine, on the wider question of reforms and reform delays, perhaps going also from your experience on wearing the other hat as well. So I would like to open it up for questions.
Two questions. Yes, one can see this in a very general terms, but I could ask, yes, I mean, if it depends upon shapes of preference, curves, and shapes of constraints, does the question then becomes, I mean, how do you change the shapes of those curves, which is possible, how do you change the slopes of the constraints? I can see that with different slopes, with different curves, you get different outcomes, but actually how do you move from how do you change the shape, I'm not sure. A more practical question is the one that comes out of your conclusions, which is the suggestion that the compensation of losers and possibly, I mean, I think, you know, what the term assistance here means, possibly investment means to facilitate this process, because that might involve the compensation of the losers. Yeah. And the question is, who are the losers, and are they necessarily people who deserve to be compensated, or should they actually be people who ought to be expropriated or suppressed? And the presumption here is that, you know, kind of everybody's entitled to some compensation, and if you're a criminal or something like that, you should be compensated for ceasing your criminal activities as much as if you were a virtuous person who happened to be, I don't know, in a wrong employment sector or something like this and lost his or her job as a result of some kind of structural reform.
Thank you. Shall I wait for the next one?
There's many questions here, so
yeah,
if you want
will,
to...
Yeah. Okay, I will explain. I'll try to respond first to the second question, then we'll come back to the first, then we'll, because we need to go back to the figure. So, compensation of the loss, what I mean here is, assume that you have to reduce the public administration. And then you need funds or transition program for people who are leaving the job. Assume that we introduce environmental standards. We will need again transitional period and certain financing for investments that they need to do. And this is mainly about this. And when we talk about compensation, when we about the criminal acts. If someone is involved in corruption and crime, it has another channel. The channel that is on the line, so I come to the first question that you made. So here, how we move. So we say that this is this depends on overall attitude of the EU support, of the EU skepticism, credibility of the process, and corruption of the government. So what happens with this? If there is a corruption, and what the new approach says, actually the new approach moves this to the left. It says that you start with chapter 23 and 24, it's the rule of law, justice, human rights, governance. So this is also corruption moving there. So this moving to the left will have, assume that we move this now from here to this point, and actually the same government with the same credibility will have a consistent time, consistent equilibrium here. They will not have any more an incentive to go to the left, because here they are not, they have no interest to reduce more than this point. So this is what happens, how we move this graph here. But if there is a government wants to move also this to the, let's say, to this, maybe it sounds very technical, but I have to explain this. So if there is a reform of Irish public, and you want to support to increase the reforms. So what happens? Then you have this financial assistance for people who leave their jobs or what they just mentioned. Then you move this to the shape of this. So you make the society more pro-reform. They will support reforms of this. And with the government, if you want to change the government's preferences, you actually try to make for the government, you try to offer more policies that will make the reforms more sound. But I just was saying, if you have within the new approach, what is mentioned, these action plans and commitments, that is clear and more transparent process, then the government will change this. They will become more pro-reform, because their alternative is higher cost. So this is how the process will move overall, and how they become also pro-reform is this additional initiatives that we have, Berlin process, investment, regional investment, that the countries get benefits from the European Union. And they will, for example, I'll bring you the case of Western Balkans investment framework. And we as a country, we as a government, were supposed to introduce separate transparent program or a table, which is a new model in compliance with what EU was suggesting to us, having this cross-sectorial approach. So first of all, you have a transparent list, everyone knows what are there. The second, you have the also what are the criteria that you made the preference list. So we were forced as a government to do this, all countries from the region, in order to be able, eligible to apply for Western Balkans investment funds. So this is how the government from this point began, because the government has its own priorities and wanted to, for example, we had two competing projects. One was with the highway with Skopje Pristina, and then was the railway with Sofia. So in 2015 there were these two projects. The railway was not supported because we needed the soft measures. The soft measures that they asked us reforms were that you need new software which increases the safety of the railway in the country. So what happened the first year, in 2015, only one project was, and it was only one project was supported from Western Balkan Investment Framework, which is was around 700,000 euros, and the other project was much a larger amount of money, but we are not eligible. So we had to do the next year what was suggested, soft measures, in order to be eligible. So in 2016 we got the other project. So this is how the European Union can change this shape. So what the model tells us, because the what is behind this, what are the incentives and the mechanism that works on decision making on the policy makers, and with introducing the political factor and this political economy impact, and then the rest is how political what will be political policy implications and suggestions. So more or less this is about your question.
Yes. Following on from that, in a scenario where you have a reform-averse government, but essentially two different publics, one that is very much in favour of reform and the other that is less in favour, how does that affect the model? And does the difference in the two different publics hinder the ability of the European Union to move a reform-averse government towards being pro-reform? And by all means, speak with reference to your country, if that's helpful.
Yeah. if we assume a reform-averse government, and we assume that the public, we have two different public, and it's the simple answer is once which one will become the majority, and you have the election process that will make that change. But that's true. But the model does not see that. The model just assumes that on the majority that you have this. You see, you're mentioning this reform-averse government, but you have this. So the model does not make this two different society, public, two different societies. It takes one. In an average, it's either the majority is pro-reform or less reform. So they dictate, the majority dictates who is going to be the in the government, in power. So that's how the model. But
because from a policy implication perspective, the European Union might want to address those different publics.
Then Europe, exactly. But then what we suggest from the model, then EU, it's more effective to intervene on the public rather than in the government and that situation, because here you just increase this the public group, which is more reform, and then they will make a pressure to the government.
So you would work on the public that is averse to reform.
Yeah, it's Europeization, it's soft measures, what NGO, civil sector. So all of this will shift the public from this to this. So So that's that is will be more effective rather than expecting that in such situation the reformer's government will change.
And then one of the implications of that is that it might encourage a reformer's government to become more averse to reform, to react against the European Union's efforts.
No. You see, if we have this model, I can't draw it now. If we have this, it changes the. If you have this, this public, and you have the see reform others government. You see what happens? Then, let me put like this. Then you have here. It will be the lower reform gap. To be a lower reform gap. The same government will behave differently. If it is the government, if it is the public which is the reform averse, then the gap will be here. You see, in extreme case. Assume that you have a reform averse government, and you have a public which is pro-reform. Then the pro-reform, it will be here. You have less gap. But if you have also the public which is reform averse, then you end up with higher gap. So they actually they compensate each other. So this is the different combinations which come up. But the model does not consider two separate society or the public is one agent and the government is the other agent. You either have the majority, but if the average is pro-reform or reform averse, then you have different. Then you have different points here. This will be either here, or it depends on the
side. But on the, sorry, if I can come in on the, so till the model assumes homogeneous public, yes, so everybody has the same preferences.
Yeah.
But on the question of whether the EU should prioritize, you know, should treat, so to speak, the anti-reform public or the pro or support the pro-reform public, I guess the implication of the model is that it has to target the anti-reform, you know, the ones that block reforms. Yeah. Yeah? So the treatment doesn't come to those who are pro-reform. You know, the problem in the in the equilibrium is with the fact that there's not enough support for reforms.
Yes. You're right. Yeah? So if that was the question, yes, it was much clearer. Yeah.
That's the criminals.
That's
do you know any?
that's exactly what they think
that's clear. If the model does not go, yes, Vasilis explained, it's homogeneous. But if you go in a practice, the model suggests that exactly. You can pick up these, let's say, if you want to fight the corruption, you hit the criminals. Then that creates a better. That shifts the overall, the average moves from this to that. So that's.
Yeah, I also had was thinking about these different publics. So we have, you said there might be a section of public which is pro-reform, one is anti-reform. And yet, how about when actually you can't define the you know different sections of the public in pro and anti-reform? But when both of them could be pro-reform in a way. I mean, explain. So, for instance, taking the you know, empirical example of Serbia now, if you would consider the government being pro-reform, at least in its rhetoric, and the opposition to it, then you would say from your model and from what you explained, you would say that it's anti. But I don't think that the popular opposition to the Serbian government would define itself as being anti-reform, but rather that they want to do reforms that are not the same as the one that the government wants. Yeah? So this brings me to the fact that maybe it would be useful to define better what you mean exactly by reform in your model. So and also, first of all, is it only legislation or implementation as well? And you know, and just highlight somehow the problems, inherent problems in actually pushing through reforms that are the right ones that go into the direction that, that specifically chapters maybe 23 and 24, which are the critical ones that you highlighted, go towards. Because the picture doesn't seem to be so clear everywhere, right? Which each of the countries has its own specificity, and in each case, I think we could argue on whether the path of the pro-reformists is actually going into that direction or not.
No, thank you. Yeah, thank you. So there are some comments, suggestions. Just about this that you referred on the reforms, maybe it will be defined here and more clear in the beginning. As I mentioned, it's in the limitations. So it's considering the case only the case where the reforms, but we have to be more specific, as I mentioned, the administration, environmental, and this. And it's addressing this certain group of interest in the society. It's not the overall society, and for very specific reforms. But that's a useful suggestion, so make more specific which reforms we talk. Yeah.
Can I bring in a question? Again, I will use the graph, but the point is not about how Kirchner. So the red line, in some way, it can be seen as the kind of trust for the natural support. How much you yeah. trust the government, and then you put a lot of emphasis on how the EU can shift that. Its credibility gap in this version of the graph, which then it makes sense that the EU can affect the credibility of a government. Intuitively, it makes sense. A more credible government will have more trust by its public. So this aligns. But then, so just to link to Bernard's point, the first question, but then you link that to investment and assistance, so really money. Pecuniary. And then there is a bit of a disconnection. So the intuition doesn't work quite. I understand how credibility, a credible government, which is well assessed by, in the reports by the Commission, somehow gets, is trusted more by the public, even the public doesn't like what the government does. Yeah, they think, okay, this is a credible government. I understand. But then, bringing in money makes people less trustful and more corrupt prone rather than, I don't see what's the connection between investment and so the EU acting on money to improve the credibility and then the trust of the government domestically. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I see. But if we talk about this as a natural support on the government, yes. But at this stage, I'm still not very, strict on defining this as a support to the government. It's also to the reform, to the process. So, and the reason when I mentioned these packages is you need certain reforms. And the support for these kind of reforms will come if you have packages, transitional packages for say for unemployed in administration, for in businesses, for introducing new standards and these kind of things. So, but I'm still working on that. Still, the model needs some specification on these issues. So I welcome any comment on these respects.
Sorry, I was thinking about what you do with polluters. Polluters, you can either punish to prevent them from doing it, or you can bribe them to stop doing it. And it's this concept of compensation that and investment that you're talking about, which is where my concerns are. Exactly who are you compensating and how are you compensating to do what or not to do what? And if it is the case that, should I bribe you to stop polluting when actually polluting is a bad thing in the first place, seems to me to be a potentially questionable approach. But nevertheless, it seems to be envisaged in the way in which you described it. And that's why I said, it comes down to potentially bribing the criminals and paying off the criminals. And I think that was also the point which you behind me were talking about when you talked about two different groups because who are the people who need to be brought on board and compensated, between inverted commas, and are they necessarily the deserving ones? And is what they are being compensated for things that they should be compensated for, or what in fact are you really trying to sort of move something along by paying off damaging influences?
Yeah. There's an ethical question that comes in with that do you end up focusing your support on the problematic group of people rather than on the reformist supportive group of people?
Yeah, okay. If we say that you need a public administration reform that will cut administration because of the efficiency. So in this case, of course, that the public servants will not be very happy with this kind of reforms. Initially, the people who need to lose their jobs. But in order to get this support for these reforms, then you need the government needs to have certain packages for this readjusting to the market, finding new jobs. So there should be programs that will address this specific group of people. So that's what this suggests, although it needs more detailed maps. So the intention of the of this research is not yet going on such very specific cases, but what we'll suggest is that if it is the channel, if you have to do this reform that affects the certain interest groups, then you cannot ignore that.
But yes, but those are the easy, those are the easy cases, it seems to me, and that's the point. And I think, you know, kind of, I didn't use the word ethics, you did, but I was sitting next to somebody who was thinking about the corruption, and, you know, and we've talked about this as well.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you're talking about sort of rentiers who are, and people who are distorting markets and distorting political processes, and in fact you've got to move these people out of the way, are you compensating them, or should you actually be clamping down upon them? Can you say those are the two responses. That's why I use the pollution case as well. Should I bribe you to stop being nasty as a polluter? That's a permittable and that's an acceptable approach, and the World Bread Month will actually talk about that.
Clearly, there is no specific suggestion on having compensation or investments that motivates wrong incentives to these problematic groups. That's the model does not go to that specificity. So, and if it is says for this, when I mentioned this corruption, it's here. It's this natural support of the process and corruption. So it's not that in these cases, it's not that you support people who make the problem. And as you mentioned, it's a potential bribe from this group of people to the policymakers. But it's not. For sure, it's not the idea that we suggest that the model focuses on that group. What the model, as it is now, and the policy and the policy implications will need to work more specifically through the model. The model just say it doesn't make the difference whether it's what is the motivation behind the reaction to the reform. The model just say that there are groups that are not happy with reforms, and this is how it explains.
If you actually take the case of the president of the Gambia, who's just been eased out of the country, and in fact, you know, it looks like part of the deal with respect to him is to actually allow him to take quite a lot of his ill-gotten gains with him. Now, that's the sort of deal. But now, that might be unblocking sort of reform instructions, but there are ethical questions about whether that should have been done and whether that person should have been granted immunity from prosecution because he's actually being given exile in a country which is outside and has refused to participate in various international courts. Now, I'm taking that as a very extreme example, but it seems to me that a lot of what we could be talking about might be not dissimilar cases to something like that. In other words, there are people who are blocking things and preventing things. They're part of the two parts of the public. They might be small, but they might be important.
Yeah, this is important issue in common. I need to further work on this and the research more attention and see we explain this part because it's important. But
I think it's fair to say that the model has no morality. Yes, so it's very pragmatic.
It
says
it
that
has to have morality. The implication does not occur in a moral vacuum.
But the models brings is the incentives. It doesn't make the difference whether they are ethically correct or not. So incentive for someone is profit for someone, the gain instead. So this is what
chapter 23 and 24, which you're actually talking about.
That will move this. 23, 24 will move this to the left. So we'll reduce this gap. Regardless what happens with this, it will move this here, so the gap will be reduced here. So there are three interventions. This is in the government, in the society, and this, which is external, this case, but we think that this is the model thing that this is, apart from the specific reforms, this is general functioning, rule of law, justice and rule of law, and governance of fighting corruption. So this is what are the issues that will move the society to all these systemic solutions that will move this support to the left. Actually, will the credibility of the reform process or overall, including the government, will credibility will move to the will increase the credibility of support. So that's how this explains. But if we go on that specific case, it will mean that you move this to the left, and you can end up with the reform gap, which are lower than if you don't have rule of law, or let's say chapter 23 and 24 functioning. So what does, in that context, this model says that if you don't have progress on chapter 23-24, the incentive of the government for the reform gap is higher. If you have, if you move, because it's wider, and the space you end up here. If it is up to here, you end up here. So the reform gap, the incentive for not doing reforms is lower, because if someone wants to, you have a corrupted politicians or in the business community, their rule of law is effective, and then you create expectations in the society that you cannot delay the reforms anyhow, because the group of interest that has such incentive to for against reforms, they know that this in the society actually this cannot be postponed, and so this is what the model says about this specific group. If we are talking about the ethical issues or corruption, this I think.
Can I? I don't know if there's any other questions, but I would like to ask a question that takes us a bit further away from the model, maybe. So the goodness of the new approach is consistent with the model, or the model is consistent with the new approach, that you can, you know, introduce more credibility to the process and then make defection from reforms less likely. In practice, the only real experience that we have with the new approach is basically in Montenegro, where in the grand scheme of things in the Balkans, Montenegro is less of a complicated case than other countries, both its politics, I would say, but also its kind of progress with transition.
So, if we were to think about the problems in the old approach, the domestic problems that were hindering compliance with the old approach, do you see the new approach or this kind of, you know, putting forward the judiciary reform and rule of law and then having the disequilibrium clause so you can stop the whole procedure if something goes wrong with judiciary? Can it work in places like Macedonia, for example, where also the politics are more multidimensional and a little bit there?
I think the new approach definitely what will be the focus, and which is happening also with Macedonia. First of all, the progress report is not writing only about the legislation that you make. It looks at the implementation. So this is from the new approach, and this is how it is reflected in the progress report. Second, additional tools that has been used is this high-level accession and dialogue, which was also introducing in the discussion not only the government but the politicians from the opposition and the civil society in order to push for the reform, so different mechanisms. And third is having a plan or action plan with urgent, so-called urgent reform priorities, which are some benchmarks which are very difficult, you know, just ticking the boxes. It says that the impact on the influence, political influence on judiciary. So what does this mean? And when we were talking and discussing about this, what does this mean? How do you define this? He says it's as simple as the minister or prime minister does not pick up the phone and call the judge for the case. So that's and this is the new approach. It's not just the legislation. We say, okay, we have this legislation, we have this strategy, everything implemented in documents, and say, okay, this looks fine, but in paper. But when you start implementation, that's what is key. So what is what matters. And from this perspective, also having this comparative, more transparent process and comparative. This introduces more pressure to the policymakers, to the government. How do they progress? When we talk about the reforms or EU integration process, you see how Montenegro and Serbia and other countries are progressing. There are also some creative way or introduced measures that keep the reform going on. The same is with Macedonia, with these processes. And what we had now in the progress reform, progress report, for example, for the 9 years, we have recommendations. And in the last years, they say conditional recommendation. And the last 2 years, we had conditional recommendations. So it is becoming, you know, the wording is changing, the messages are clear, but still, when it comes to the process, EU still has motivation to keep the process going on, and rather than saying, you know, there is no recommendation anymore, and this is what is happening. It's like one-way process. You have a backsliding in terms of the reforms. It's a lot of wording, but the final, you know, the conclusion, the recommendation that, I mean, that the Commission sends to the Council is that still a country have a recommendation for starting negotiations. So, and here we come back to other issues and about the credibility. You know, if the expectations are reduced that the country will have will move forward with negotiations, then there is no incentive for government to be pro-reform or less. Reformed or reform averse. Then should be with a new approach also what thing can help are these creative mechanisms or instruments or tools, however we call it. For example, chapter 23 and 24. We had this self-screening process in our country about chapter 23-24. Then we proposed a mirroring model. So we follow Serbia and Montenegro. We asked European Commission to follow how Montenegro is doing screening, and we do the same, regardless that we have not started, we do the same, because the screening will help. We'll make a list of things where we stand and action plans how we improve. And then European Commission, the next try we wanted to do with Serbia and Montenegro, say it's not possible. You cannot participate and follow this. So we stopped the self-screening. We had once self-screening and it didn't stop. And we're talking about chapter 23 and 24, enforcing these reforms. And without, you know, there is a gap. European Commission is using the existing tools, so a new approach maybe needs something to bridge this, because the reforms has to happen. Meanwhile, well, the suggestions are for rule of law and what is in 23-24, justice and rest. So this is when we talk about, as you mentioned, about question whether the new approach,
well, if it can work in more difficult cases, but yeah, basically that, but then you say that it's not easy to apply unless you are into the process, so that you, yeah, yeah. On that, I don't know if it's positive or negative note, but if there are no more questions, please thank me. Please join me in thanking our speaker for the presentation and the discussion. And before you leave, I have to make two announcements. Our next event is a book launch on the very interesting book, Conversations with Milosevic. Our speaker will be Sir Ivor Roberts. It's on 7th of February, that's a Tuesday, 7th February, in this room, yes. And then our next research seminar is on Tuesday, 28th February, a very long title, For the Individual, the Demos, or the Group, Evaluating the Prospects for a Liberal Bosnia-Herzegovina in Light of Ideological Alternatives. So our next event, 7th of February, 28th of February, please join us.